one more example of the kind of sloppy, careless, incompetent behavior, particularly towards classified information.
On Capitol Hill, top U.S. intelligence officials faced intense questions from senators about information shared on Signal.
For Tuesday, March 25th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. As the Trump administration pursues deportation of several foreign-born scholars, we look back at the L.A. Eight.
They were arrested decades ago on charges related to pro-Palestinian activism.
What we established in the L.A. Eight case was that the First Amendment protects all of us in the United States. It doesn't limit its protections to citizens.
And 23andMe just filed for bankruptcy. What happens to our data?
23andMe does provide the ability for folks to go ahead and delete their genetic profile.
Also, a look at the future of federal aid for small towns and farms.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The nation's top two intelligence officials testified they did not share classified information in a group chat about the U.S. bombing campaign in Yemen. As NPR's Greg Myrie explains, Democratic senators pushed back aggressively against those claims.
CIA Director John Ratcliffe and the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, told the Senate Intelligence Committee that they have not shared classified material outside of proper channels. They did not speak on behalf of other officials who were also part of the group on the Signal messaging app. Senator Mark Warner of Virginia said national security officials in the Trump administration have already taken a number of actions he described as, quote, sloppy, careless, incompetent behavior. The hearing came just a day after journalist Jeffrey Goldberg wrote that he was inadvertently included in the group chat with other national security officials. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Washington.
NPR CEO Catherine Marr chairs the board of the Signal Foundation, which supports the Signal app. President Trump is defending his national security advisor, Mike Waltz, following the accidental inclusion of a journalist in the messaging app group chat about the U.S. attack on Yemen. Trump also repeating assertions no classified information was involved. Waltz said technical experts and lawyers at the National Security Council were looking at the incident, but he slammed The Atlantic and the media over the focus on the issue. In Gaza, Palestinians staged a rare protest against Hamas, the militant group that rules the territory. Israel resumed fighting last week to pressure Hamas to release the remaining hostages. More from NPR's Daniel Estrin.
Videos posted on social media show crowds chanting, out, 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 Hamas go out. Protesters called for media coverage, chanting, where is the media? Eyewitnesses say thousands took part in the demonstration in Beit Lahia in northern Gaza, which began as an anti-war protest. One protester who requested we only use his first name, Ibrahim, to speak freely against Hamas, told NPR, Hamas is not taking us into account. It has 2 million people in Gaza who need to live. He called on Hamas to release the Israeli hostages and leave Gaza. Over the years, Hamas has cracked down on dissent, but open criticism has grown during the war. Hamas did not break up the protest. It issued no comment. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Vice President J.D. Vance says he'll join his wife, Usha Vance, in visiting Greenland this week. The second lady announced a cultural visit to the Danish territory, sparking consternation from political leaders in Greenland and Denmark, who are concerned about Trump administration's interest in acquiring the territory. While Usha Vance has said she planned to attend a dog sled race, she and the vice president now say they'll visit a U.S. Space Force base on the island. Stocks closed modestly higher on Wall Street today. This is NPR. Five high-level officials at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are announcing they are leaving. The departures were announced today at a meeting of agency senior leaders. While the latest exodus, roughly a third of the agency's top management has now stepped down. The United Nations says U.S. funding cuts to global HIV/AIDS efforts will lead to millions of deaths over the next 4 years. More from NPR's Fatma Tanis.
Officials with the United Nations Program on HIV/AIDS said the sudden withdrawal of U.S. support was having a, quote, devastating effect. UNAIDS Executive Director Winnie Byanyima said on Monday that the cuts had led to closures of clinics in many African countries and severe shortages of life-saving HIV medications. Byanyima warned that the cuts would lead to 2,000 new infections each day and over 6 million deaths over the next 4 years.
See it come back and we'll see people dying the way we saw them in the 90s and in the 2000s.
Until the Trump administration's pause on foreign aid, the U.S. had been the biggest funder of HIV treatment and prevention around the world. Fatma Tanis, NPR News.
Robotaxi company Waymo says it's adding Washington, D.C. to its list of cities where it's pioneering the latest technology that will be another year before actual driverless taxis are on the streets. For now, the company's robotaxis are mapping D.C. streets and corridors with a driver behind the wheel to take control if something goes wrong. Waymo's robotaxis are already providing service in Phoenix, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Austin. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. This is NPR.
It's 6 minutes after 4 o'clock. Thank you for listening to All Things Considered on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. We receive support from ICTV. ICTV connects, informs, and empowers the community through diverse media. Learn more at watchictv.org. Mostly cloudy skies tonight with lows 20 to 27, and tomorrow a mix of clouds and sun, highs 44 to 51, winds from the west 5 to 15. Sunny on Thursday, highs in the upper 40s to mid 50s.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Baltimore.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Today, senators grilled top U.S. intelligence officials on Capitol Hill. This after The Atlantic reported that the magazine's top editor was added to a group chat on the widely available messaging app Signal, where top national security officials for the Trump administration were sharing details about military plans to bomb Yemen. We should note that NPR CEO Catherine Marr is chair of the board of Signal Foundation, which runs the Signal messaging app. At the Senate hearing today, here is what Georgia Democrat John Ossoff said.
This is utterly unprofessional. There's been no apology. There has been no recognition of the gravity of this error.
The top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, Mark Warner of Virginia, slammed the incident as mind-boggling. Senator Warner joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so you and your fellow Democrats, as expected, had pretty sharp words today for the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, and John Ratcliffe, head of the CIA, notably. None of your Republican colleagues seemed intent on focusing at all on this whole Signal episode. Do you have a sense of whether any of those Republicans share your concerns?
I think they do, and I think it was extraordinarily telling that none of my Republican colleagues came to these folks' defense. If anybody hasn't heard, let's just review very quickly. You know, Signal is a good encrypted application, but it is not a classified means of transmitting information. Matter of fact, right, we have evidence that Russia and China have tried to break into Signal-based systems. Two, you've got this senior level of individuals communicating on this non-classified channel, and plain sloppiness put a journalist on, and nobody bothered to check who's this other person on the line.
But I ask you, if none of your Republican colleagues are willing to speak out against what happened, without their support in seeking accountability, are we going to see any accountability?
Well, I think we will. Listen, I think we're going to see the full text. I think the journalist is thinking about releasing it. And if Gabbard said today, there's nothing classified, well, there's nothing classified, there's no reason why it shouldn't be released.
Right, share it with the committee.
She refused to acknowledge whether she was using her phone, a government phone. But just, Elsa, step back for a moment. Even with what we know right now, we have the Vice President of the United States disagreeing with others about an imminent bombing. Having that information, if it had gone out ahead of time, I can tell you the Russia and China, Iran, that's what their spies would love to have. That very information alone in any traditional way would be viewed as classified and not supposed to be disclosed.
Let's talk about the classified nature or non-classified nature of the information, because you're right. Gabbard said that there was no classified material shared on that chat. But if Jeffrey Goldberg's reporting is correct, that text thread included the name of a CIA officer and information about targets, weapons the U.S. would be deploying, attack sequencing. Are there any conceivable circumstances where none of that information would be classified? You tell me.
There was no conceivable circumstance. And let me acknowledge, we overclassify in this country, but they shouldn't be changing the rules. And the hypocrisy here of the Director of National Intelligence, who literally 11 days ago tweeted out, like, we're going to go after every leaker and anybody that leaks, we're going to pursue to the full extent of the law. And then to be so cavalier and treat this information, because if it had gotten out, Americans could have died in terms of the Houthis being able to reconfigure or redirect their defensive capabilities. This is kind of security 101. If this had been a military officer or a CIA case officer, they would be fired with this kind of behavior, without question.
If it turns out that Jeffrey Goldberg and The Atlantic decide not to release further content of what Goldberg saw on that group chat, you did ask Gabbard today. You said, well, if nothing's classified, then share the contents with the committee. How do you proceed at that point if you want to see those contents that are apparently non-classified, according to her?
One of the things I have loved about the Intelligence Committee, I was chair under the last administration, I'm vice chair now, is that we have a tendency of almost always being bipartisan. I absolutely believe if the administration tries to stonewall this, we will have bipartisan support. For us as the Intelligence Committee, the oversight committee that's supposed to be making sure things are appropriate, we'll get a look at this transcript.
But let me ask you this.
Add one quick thing. Can I just add one last quick thing here on this? If this was the first time, it would still be awful, but it wouldn't be as awful as it is right now. This is the same administration that a couple weeks in inadvertently released the names of 200 CIA new agents, many of those who now can't be deployed. And this is the administration that Elon Musk and his so-called Doge boys release classified information almost on a daily basis.
All right. Well, we are now out of time. Thank you so much. That is Senator Mark Warner of Virginia, the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee. It was good to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
Just a few weeks ago, Hamdan Bahlul was standing on stage at the Academy Awards. He was collecting an Oscar after the film he co-directed called No Other Land won Best Documentary. The film depicts the violence and harassment Palestinians face in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. And last night, Bahlul lived that violence when his village in the West Bank was attacked by extremist Israeli settlers, and he was detained by the Israeli military. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf spoke to several eyewitnesses and brings this report.
Nasser Nawaje lives in the Palestinian village of Susia, the same village as Hamdan Bahlul. He says yesterday evening, right as everyone was getting ready to break the fast for the holy month of Ramadan, a group of settlers stormed part of the village. They attacked houses and smashed cars, he says, and started attacking people.
And as soon as we sat down to eat, we received word that there was an attack near the school in Susia.
28-year-old Josh Kimmelman was in a nearby village when he got a message about the settlers in Susia. Kimmelman is an American, but staying in that part of the West Bank for several months as part of the Center for Jewish Nonviolence, a group that integrates with Palestinian villages at risk of Israeli attacks.
We call it protective presence.
Yesterday evening, he and several other activists drove the short distance to Susia to see if they could de-escalate the situation, but also to document it.
We pulled up. We could see the silhouettes of settlers and soldiers.
A few of them got out of the car and started filming, right as the settlers turned to attack them.
Hey, no, no!
A settler came towards us and started screaming at us. All their faces were covered. This one guy shoved me.
Jenna, also an American, is an activist with the same organization.
Back to the car!
So we tried to run back to our car, and settlers hit us with sticks.
NPR agreed not to use Jenna's last name because she doesn't want her employer to retaliate against her for her activism. In the video they filmed, you can see masked young men hurling rocks at the car, smashing the windshield and breaking the car windows while the activists are inside.
Guys, are you okay?
We're okay. The car is broken.
It was around this same time, the activists say, that Hamdan Bahlul was also beaten and then taken away by Israeli soldiers, along with two other Palestinians. The Israeli military said all three were throwing stones at security forces. The military says an Israeli was also taken into custody. All the eyewitnesses NPR talked to, who all know Bahlul, don't believe the charges against him. Here's Kimmelman.
he is committed as well, like us, to principles of nonviolence.
The film No Other Land documents events like those that took place last night, as violent settlers try to intimidate Palestinians into leaving their homes. Attacks have been on the rise since the 2023 war began in Gaza, and Israeli security forces often turn a blind eye. Belal was detained overnight at an Israeli military base, where he was interrogated by security forces, his lawyer told NPR. He was released later today. His lawyer says he immediately requested to be taken to the hospital for medical attention. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The first Black Republican Congresswoman has died. Mia Love represented Central Utah from 2015 to 2019. KUER's Sean Higgins reports on her life and career.
The daughter of Haitian immigrants, Love was born in New York and raised in Connecticut. It was there, while in college, she met her husband, who was on a Latter-day Saint mission. They moved to Utah in the late 90s. Love's political career began in the small city of Saratoga Springs, Utah, where she became the first Black woman mayor in the state. During her first run for Congress in 2012, she described her politics this way.
A lot of people have tried to put me in a box somewhere, and as everybody knows, I'm not easily put in a box. I hope that that message that I have of fiscal discipline, limited government, personal responsibility resonates from Tea Party all the way over to moderate.
Utah Lieutenant Governor Deidre Henderson, a close friend, said while Love may have achieved many firsts, she never let them define her.
She understood that she was breaking barriers and that she was first in a lot of those things, but she herself never leaned on that. So when people called her a rising star, it wasn't because she was a Black female Republican. It was because she was really talented.
In Congress, Love was a reliable conservative vote and served on a House panel that investigated Planned Parenthood. In Congress, during President Trump's first term, Love did not shy away from criticizing him after he used an expletive to describe Haiti and developing countries in Africa. Love said the comments were racist and called on Trump to apologize. Here she is in the audiobook of her 2023 memoir.
To have a president of the United States of America who seemed incapable of having relationships, only convenient transactions, mock you after a tough election loss, or call your ancestral home a can be devastating, disconcerting, and disappointing.
After leaving office in 2019, she worked as a political commentator at CNN. Love was first diagnosed with brain cancer in 2022 and publicly shared it a year later. Mia Love was 49 years old. For NPR News, I'm Sean Higgins in Salt Lake City.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. It is 4:18. I'm Jennifer Barr. We receive support from the Veteran Mental Health Crisis Response Team of Itasca County. This crisis intervention service is a program of first call for help 211 and provides free crisis assessments, stabilization services, referrals, and resourcing to veterans and their families who are in crisis. Trained providers are available to serve fellow veterans 24 hours a day, 7 days a week by dialing 211. Here's John Latimer.
On today's date, March 25th in the year 2000, I find my first blue-spotted salamander of the year. The salamanders have spent the winter in the leaf litter, maybe under a log somewhere, staying unfrozen, and now they are getting out and moving about. Their goal this time of year is to find a nearby vernal pond, one of those places that will hold water until at least midsummer, because once the salamanders wake up, as this one has, they will find a mate and copulate, and ultimately the female will begin laying eggs on debris around the edges of these vernal ponds, probably 10 to 12 eggs at a spot, and then maybe 500 eggs total. The babies will hatch about a month later. They'll have well-developed eyes and mouths. And after about a week, their front legs will begin to develop. Oddly enough, if you check out a blue-spotted salamander close distance, you'll see that they have four toes on their front legs and five toes on their back legs. Enjoy them and keep those vernal ponds clean, because that is exceptionally important to the life of the salamander.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. One morning in January of 1987, Michel Shahada, a Palestinian man who'd lawfully emigrated to the United States as a teenager, was taking care of his toddler son at home when federal agents arrived at his door and arrested him at gunpoint. Shahada soon learned he was one of eight immigrants, mostly students and known as the LA 8, arrested on charges relating to their pro-Palestinian activism. Fast forward to this month, when federal agents arrested Mahmoud Khalil, a recent Columbia University graduate student, and Georgetown professor Badar Khansouri. Like the LA 8, both are in the U.S. legally, being threatened with deportation, and both are targets of the Trump administration's crackdown on what they describe as anti-Semitic pro-Hamas speech on college campuses across the country. For insight into this moment and what we can learn from the plight of the LA 8, we turn now to David Cole. He represented the LA 8 over their 20-year fight to remain in the United States. David Cole, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I just want to start by asking you, as briefly as you can, could you just walk us through what happened to the LA 8?
Well, as you indicated in your opening, they were arrested at gunpoint. They were all detained initially as national security threats. When we challenged that assertion, the government said it wanted to rely on secret evidence that we couldn't see to show that they were security threats. The judge said, no, I'm not going to look at secret evidence unless you can show it to the defendants, essentially. And the government said, okay, well, then we're not going to show it to the judge either, and they were allowed out. After about the first month, they were free for the entire 20-year saga of their case. But it took 20 years to prevail in a case in which the government targeted our clients for essentially advocating for Palestinian self-determination.
As you mentioned, these cases went on for more than two decades. How did that affect the lives of the LA 8, their families?
Well, the principal restriction on them was that they weren't able to leave the country. And so a number of them lost parents who were living back in Palestine and were unable to go see their parents in the last years, months, days of their lives without giving up their right to stay in this country. And they just had, for two decades, hanging over their heads the fact that they may lose the right to be in this country, despite the fact that they engaged in no unlawful activity, because of what they said and what they believed in.
What are the similarities that you see between their case and those that are being brought today against Mahmoud Khalil and the others?
Well, it's really deja vu all over again. The government is targeting Palestinians engaged in nothing more than protest activities on campuses. Why? Because the government disagrees with the viewpoints expressed. And so they are seeking to deport people for their speech. And what we established in the LA 8 case was that the First Amendment protects all of us in the United States.
In order to pursue these deportations, the government is using a rarely invoked part of the Immigration and Nationality Act that allows the U.S. Secretary of State to deport any non-citizen whose presence in the U.S. could be deemed to have, and I'm quoting here, adverse foreign policy consequences for the United States. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has made the claim that Khalil's case, at least, it's not about free speech, but it's about who is and who is not allowed to be in the country to begin with.
What do you make of that argument?
First of all, the notion that a college student's speech on a single campus in the United States somehow poses serious adverse foreign policy consequences is laughable. But in addition, it's a violation of the First Amendment, because what is the basis upon which he says Mr. Khalil's activities undermine our foreign policy? Nothing more than his pure speech. And speech is protected for all of us.
If the government is successful in deporting someone like Khalil or Badar Khansouri, what kind of ripple effects might that have for free speech in the United States?
Well, it will send a tremendous chill across this country, and that is its intention. President Trump on Truth Social essentially said, you know, this is the first step. We're going to go after anyone who engages in what he calls illegal protests, which he seems to define as protests he doesn't like. But the First Amendment is here to say that is not the government's prerogative. The government in the United States has to tolerate speech, even speech that it disapproves of, especially speech that it disapproves of.
David Cole is a former lawyer for the LA 8 and national legal director for the ACLU. He is now at Georgetown Law. David, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain Podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. And today's story comes from Eleanor Higginbotham. It was December 31st, 2022, and her first New Year's Eve alone. Higginbotham's husband of 62 years, Erland, had died in June. That afternoon, she went to the post office to drop off some holiday cards, and when she returned to her car, it wouldn't start. So she went back to the post office and asked the people inside if anyone could jump her car. Right away, a woman volunteered, joined by a friend.
And they were working and working and working and nothing. It was totally dead. And another couple of cars came in. Finally, we had four cars in the parking lot, all of them trying to help this old lady. Finally, somebody did start the car. It was about 40 minutes, I think, that people were working on it. Everybody was very worried about this old lady getting home because now it was dark. And I said, everybody should come home with me and have a tea party. You can follow me. But the first woman, Sumaya, was the one who stayed for the whole thing. Sumaya followed me home. And not only did she come home with me, but she came upstairs with me. And we did, in fact, have a tea party. We had cookies and tea, and we started talking. And we found that we had a lot in common. You know, I had concerns with aging and losing a husband and what I was going to do next. She had her own concerns. And we were really quite frank with each other, two strangers who really had known nothing about each other, became pretty close in a period when the world seems pretty intent on meanness, stinginess, greediness, and all of that. This was great generosity of time and skill and attention. I'm an Emily Dickinson scholar. I love her work. And when this event happened to me, I thought of this poem of hers. A deed knocks first at thought, and then it knocks at will, and then goes out an act. That's what goodness is about, really, is action. But first of all, of course, it has to come from the mind and the heart, and these people who are kind did that.
Eleanor Higginbotham lives in Bethesda, Maryland. She and Sumaya Zane are still friends. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at myunsunghero.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Mathnasium, committed to making math fun and building confidence so students can achieve their potential this school year, offering customized math instruction and individual attention to students in grades K through 12. Mathnasium.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Lollapalooza defined what rock would become in the early 90s, with bands such as Soundgarden, Alice in Chains, and Green Day performing on their main stage. Today, well, it's just not something that could be put together quite easily.
A festival like this that would tour around the country with this many
artists of that stature is actually impossible to do.
The history of Lollapalooza, tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition begins at 5 a.m. tomorrow on KAXE. Tune in for the Wednesday morning show with Andrew DeZingle and Heidi Holton. At 8:45, Area Voices, Andrew's talking with Patrick Strait about his new book, Home Club, all about the Acme Comedy Club in Minneapolis. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a few moments, National Native News. We receive support from the Bonner Eye Clinic with locations in Grand Rapids and Hibbing, welcoming Dr. Carlisle to their team, offering lid and cataract surgery, general eye exams, and more. BonnerEyeClinic.com. Let us help you see clearly. Our listeners love supporting the businesses that support KAXE. If you are interested in connecting with our listeners, call 218-326-1234. Ask for Peggy, Jen, or Chris. A big thanks to all of our current business supporters. Mostly cloudy overnight with lows 20 to 27, and tomorrow mix of clouds and sun, highs 44 to 51, west winds 5 to 15. Sunny on Thursday, highs in the upper 40s to mid 50s.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. South Dakota Republican Senator Mike Rounds has requested the issue of violent crime be addressed on the nation's reservations. In a letter to Attorney General Pam Bondi and Secretary of Interior Doug Burgum, the senator has requested the creation of the Violent Crime Reduction Commission, specifically for tribal lands. This comes after several tribes address concerns about violent crime conditions. Rounds describes the situation on Great Plains Reservation communities as, quote, a public safety crisis. Historically, reservations have seen higher than average rates of violent crime than the larger U.S., while contending with understaffing of law enforcement services. A report that highlighted the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous people was removed from several federal websites last month, to the disappointment of some Alaska Native advocates. The final report by the Not Invisible Act Commission was a joint effort by the U.S. Justice and Interior Departments completed in 2023. It focused on the disproportionate rates of assault and murder in Indigenous communities across the country, as well as unique issues faced by Alaska Native people. President Trump signed the law that mandated the report during his first term. In February, the report's authors and advocates noticed that the link had been deleted from several federal websites, including the Department of Justice. The reason for the removal was not immediately clear. Michelle Demmer is a longtime tribal judge and University of Alaska Fairbanks professor who is one of the report's commissioners. Demmer, who's Tlingit and Haida, says she was deeply disappointed with its removal.
It's like a slap in the face. It just really saddens me then to have the report removed like it doesn't even exist.
For 18 months, the commission heard from people across the country, including in Anchorage, Bethel, and Emonic. Those stories were included in the final report.
People traveled far and wide to come give testimony about situations that involved their loved ones. They trusted us with their stories, even though it was painful for them to have to retell these stories, but they felt like this might be the one opportunity that someone hears them and takes action.
Charlene Akpik-Apak is the executive director of the nonprofit Data for Indigenous Justice. Apak, who's Anupiak, attended the commission hearing that was held in Anchorage. She found it unsettling that the report was deleted from websites, but she does not want people to be discouraged.
We still know what was said. We still know our truth. We still know our stories, and they can't take that away from us. Our knowledge and our truth is something that cannot be erased.
Apak says she appreciates the report's specific recommendations for Alaska, which spoke to historic violence against Alaska Native women, the landscape and structure of rural communities, and challenges with legal and public safety systems. She adds that despite the report's removal, organizations like Data for Indigenous Justice will continue to document and track cases of violence against Indigenous people in Alaska. The Center for Native American Youth has announced its cohort for this year's Remembering Our Sisters Fellowship. The virtual storytelling and digital arts program supports Native youth who are raising awareness about missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit. During the six-month program, fellows will create digital art and storytelling projects to bring attention to the issue. Six fellows from tribes across the country, including from Oklahoma, Arizona, and California, were chosen for the program. Fellows will receive technical assistance, mentorship, and opportunities to share their projects. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the American Indian College Fund, providing millions of dollars of scholarships to Native students every year. Applications are accepted through May 31st at collegefund.org.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at metamucil.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Baltimore.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Republicans on Capitol Hill say that federal judges ruling against the Trump administration are abusing their power.
It's like we have hundreds of mini Supreme Courts.
Missouri Senator Josh Hawley wants to prevent federal district judges from issuing rulings that have far-reaching national implications. Other Republicans have another idea: impeachment. NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh joins us now from the Capitol. Hi, Deirdre.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so checks and balances in the Constitution. Yes, Congress has oversight authority over the federal judiciary. Do Republican lawmakers have a clear plan on how they want to do that?
Well, they have a range of ideas, but they're not really united on what they want to do. It is worth noting that there have been a series of decisions ruling against Trump, executive orders and other actions by the administration. And these have come from judges that were appointed by both Democratic and Republican presidents. The biggest one right now causing the most blowback from Republicans on Capitol Hill is from U.S. District Court James Boasberg.
Right.
He questioned President Trump's use of the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 to deport some Venezuelans to El Salvador. The administration says those individuals were part of a gang that's labeled a terrorist organization. President Trump has already called for this judge's impeachment, and Texas Republican Brandon Gill filed a resolution to do that. It's worth noting Elon Musk has also called for impeaching judges that have ruled against some of his actions to reshape the federal government. Gill told me he thinks in Boasberg's case, the judge is stepping on the commander-in-chief's authority to remove people he thinks are a threat.
But have House Republicans lined up the votes to impeach this judge or any other judges whom they have disagreed with?
No, and even some House Republicans admit they don't have the votes to do that. You know, I asked Senate Majority Leader John Thune about this push by House Republicans to impeach judges, and he told me he thinks the appeals process is how disagreements over judges' decisions will ultimately be how this all gets handled. Democrats, for their part, are causing the push to impeach or any other moves against judges as political retribution.
Well, just remind us, Deirdre, what would it actually take to impeach a federal judge?
First, a House would have to pass an impeachment resolution. Even if the House had the votes to do that, Republican Tom Tillis, who's on the Senate Judiciary Committee, told me that impeachment would be, in his words, an unmitigated waste of time. That's because it takes a supermajority, 67 votes, to convict and remove a judge. It's unlikely that any Democrats would vote with Republicans. Mm-hmm. I actually pressed Gill about this sort of political reality, and he said he still thinks the House should act.
What we can do in the House is separate from that, and I think just getting an impeachment bill through the House would send a pretty clear message to rogue activist judges.
Okay, well, if impeachment does not work, what are the other Republican proposals to restrict the federal courts?
One proposal Republicans on both sides of the Capitol are talking about is limiting the power of district judges to issue injunctions. That's actually is expected to get a House vote next week. California Republican Darrell Issa sponsored the bill, and he talks about it as a way to combat what he says is a trend of district judges applying their rulings about the cases before them more broadly.
And it goes back to the very creation of district courts. We don't need a Supreme Court if 700 judges can each do what the Supreme Court does.
We heard Missouri Republican Josh Hawley talking about that issue. He has a similar bill. He says that leaving decisions with national implications to the Supreme Court is really the way he argues the system is supposed to work. Of course, President Trump appointed three of the justices on the Supreme Court, and there's a conservative majority on the high court right now.
That is NPR's Deirdre Walsh. Thank you so much, Deirdre.
Thanks, Elsa.
It's been a turbulent couple of months at the government agency committed to helping rural economies. It's called USDA Rural Development, and the turmoil it faces may erode a major source of federal aid for small towns and farms. Frank Morris of member station KCUR reports.
Raising big animals for meat is tough, and on small farms, the owners do all the work.
It's not a job that you can just shut on and off. It's a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week job, and sometimes you question your life choices when it's negative 25 wind chill. Yeah, checking calves, cutting ice, making sure that everyone's warm, you know.
Jenna Batchelder and her husband Brad and their four kids raise cattle, bison, pigs, and poultry near Belton, Missouri, south of Kansas City. They've had this farm for a decade and spent most of that time living in a walled-off and furnished section of the barn. When the pandemic hit and shut down big meatpacking plants, they saw an opportunity to sell individual cuts of meat. Brad Batchelder says a grant from USDA Rural Development made it possible.
Yeah, I mean, it was really almost life-changing for us. This grant has definitely, like, we see a path and a vision now, and that has been even more motivating to us, I think.
You see some of our steaks that we sell.
Now they're running a thriving meat shop out of the corner of the barn where they used to live.
Pork is in here. We have our beef products in this freezer here.
USDA Rural Development covers up to half their processing costs. That investment flows through the rural economy to local butchers and other suppliers and makes the food supply chain just a little stronger. USDA Rural Development is Washington's chief tool to promote economic growth in rural counties, where President Trump won, on average, almost two-thirds of the vote last year, according to AP Votecast. But Kyle Wilkins, who ran USDA Rural Development in Missouri under President Biden, says the agency is in turmoil.
Because they don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
The Trump administration first pressed USDA Rural Development employees to retire, then terminated hundreds. Now the courts are forcing the agency to rehire workers with back pay, at least temporarily.
Think of the time that you're taken away from these folks doing their actual job, and that is money. It's all it is. It's money.
And money is getting tight. Congress cut USDA Rural Development by hundreds of millions of dollars last year. Owen Hart with the National Association of Counties says the agency does things that local governments can't afford, building water supply systems for small shrinking towns, for instance, shoring up hospitals, buying police cars. It's an economic lifeline to places without a lot of options.
In a lot of these communities, USDA Rural Development is the most important partner. You can't rely on private investment coming in. The market's just often not there for it. You can't rely on philanthropy like you can in a lot of urban areas to meet some of these needs. And so rural development is a really, really crucial partner.
That includes manufacturers that President Trump is counting on to boost U.S. industrial production. Here's Kyle Wilkins again, standing outside the Miller's Custom Cabinet Factory in Excelsior Springs, Missouri, half an hour northeast of Kansas City.
That is a huge industrial building that they're making cabinets in. And half of it, which I'd say at least half a football field, is covered in solar panels. They are saving a lot of money right now in electric cost.
USDA Rural Development covered half the price of the solar array, $250,000. Wilkins says the savings will help management thrive and maybe hire more people, strengthening the economy here. Farm state politicians will work to shore up the agency that's done so much for their constituents over the decades. But Wilkins says it'll take time to heal the damage recently inflicted on USDA Rural Development. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris in Kansas City.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. In March, the World Health Organization said that more than 200 healthcare facilities had shut down or suspended operations in Afghanistan, all as a result of the Trump administration's freeze on aid funding. It said without urgent intervention, about 200 more facilities would shut down by June. On the ground, Afghan midwives tell NPR that they are already seeing the impact. NPR's Dia Hadid reports, and please note that her story includes details about the deaths of women and babies.
The midwives spoke to NPR on condition of anonymity.
They were critical of the Taliban and worry for their personal safety. They were also critical of the Trump administration and worry they'll lose their jobs, which are funded by foreign aid groups, if they're identified. That's why we've only used their first names. Laikva Izeb, a midwife who used to work in a health clinic in an isolated mountainous district. It was shut down, even as locals begged staff not to go. This week, Faiza says, she got word that a woman and her baby died in childbirth in that district. Her area was snowed in. She couldn't get to a regional hospital. Other women reach hospitals when it's too late. Midwife Karima tells NPR that one woman lost so much blood that she died on the way to the hospital where she works. Another woman, Fatima, tells NPR she encountered a woman who arrived with a baby stuck in her birth canal at the hospital where she works. She encountered another woman whose baby's legs had emerged, but the head was stuck inside. She says both those babies died. Fatima says she's from a deeply poor district. Most women, she says, give birth at home and die at home, unrecorded, because families can't afford a taxi to get a woman to hospital. Other families in her conservative area refuse to let women leave their homes, even to have a baby. She says healthcare in Afghanistan has always been tenuous, especially for women. She says it became worse after the Taliban seized power over 3 years ago. The group has banned women and girls from studying after the sixth grade. There's no new nurses, midwives, or healthcare workers. So losing US aid was a cruel blow. She says no one prioritizes women's lives. And the Trump administration's cuts to USAID triggered a domino effect of sorts. Soon after, the British Prime Minister announced his country would nearly halve its budget for foreign aid, the lowest level in nearly 30 years. He said that was to divert resources to defense spending as Washington shrinks back from its traditional NATO allies. Then a series of European countries announced cuts to their foreign aid, citing budgetary constraints, a desire to pivot to their national self-interest, and a need to spend more on defence. Heather Barr is from Human Rights Watch. She's followed Afghanistan closely for decades.
It seems to be that other donors are following the US down, and that what Trump has done really is give everyone a license to give up on funding aid.
She says it's like the Trump administration has given the wealthy West permission to not care about Afghan women. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Mumbai.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:48. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 5:30, the Up North Report, the latest news from our region. At 6 o'clock, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective with the CBC. 7 o'clock, Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. Support comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. We also thank the Lake Country Journal, a local lifestyle magazine sharing stories about places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. More at lakecountryjournal.com. Mostly cloudy tonight, lows 20 to 27, and for tomorrow, a mix of clouds and sun, highs 44 to 51, winds from the west 5 to 15. Lows tomorrow night in the upper 20s, and for Thursday, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 40s to mid 50s. Bill Jamerson will visit the Brainerd Public Library Monday, March 31st at 1 p.m., sharing stories and songs from the lumberjack era. And the Reclaiming and Advancing Leech Lake Youth Coalition is holding an interactive conversation called Changing the Narrative on Mental Health and Suicide. That's this Monday, March 31st at 6 p.m. at Walker Hackensack 8 Klee School. The conversation will also be held Thursday, April 3rd, 6 p.m. at the Onagam Community Center. For more information and to register, visit the community education page on the Walker Hackensack 8 Klee School District's website. You can let us know about events happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxc.org. Also, look for events up north each week on our website, kaxc.org. More news is next.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Some say a Wisconsin state election next Tuesday is a test for President Trump. Elon Musk has poured more than $18 million into the contest so far. On the other side, mega wealthy donors George Soros and Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker each have given more than $1 million. Chuck Kornbach of member station WUWM brings us more.
It's a race for a single seat on the Wisconsin Supreme Court that has raised as much as $100 million. It's likely the most expensive state Supreme Court election in the country's history. The last time a record was set for a state Supreme Court race was 2 years ago in Wisconsin.
Well, Wisconsin, guess what? We did it! We did it!
Winning candidate Janet Protasiewicz celebrated on election night in 2023 after giving liberals a court majority for the first time since 2008. Now that another liberal justice on the nonpartisan court is retiring, Republicans are again making a play for control. Elon Musk-funded ads take aim at the Democrats' favorite Supreme Court candidate, Dane County Circuit Judge Susan Crawford.
That was Crawford's choice.
One commercial argues Crawford gave a light sentence to a man who sexually assaulted a child.
Another dangerous decision from Susan Crawford, putting all our kids at risk. She's just wrong for Wisconsin.
Crawford defends her decisions for those found guilty and says what's out of place in Wisconsin are Musk's Political Action Committee's efforts to turn out voters for her opponent, Waukesha County Circuit Judge Brad Schimmel.
The Musk PACs are distributing flyers that say protect the Trump agenda with Brad Schimmel. That's obviously a very partisan message, and it's not what the Wisconsin Supreme Court is for.
Musk has claimed his top concern is that if Crawford is elected, the liberal state court would redistrict two Wisconsin House seats to give Democrats a chance to win the chamber in 2026. Musk said that this past weekend when he welcomed Schimmel on his social media platform, X.
And then we won't be able to get through the changes that the American people want.
Democratic House Leader Hakeem Jeffries also said this week that the Wisconsin contest is important for House redistricting. But Crawford says she hasn't made any promises on redrawing congressional lines. Also over the weekend, President Trump endorsed Schimmel. The conservative judge told reporters he made no promises in return.
Absolutely nothing. He called me and he knows about the race and he knows that it's important that we have the rule of law in Wisconsin.
Crawford is also getting help from well-known billionaires, including George Soros and Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker. Her campaign says she alone has raised more than $26 million since entering the race, an amount they say is more than any other judicial race in American history. And Wisconsin Democratic Party Chair Ben Wickler has been holding something he calls People versus Musk town halls.
The world's richest man, not content to be running the federal government, is also trying to buy our state Supreme Court.
After this town hall, Deb Kohler, who calls herself an independent voter from a mostly Republican family, criticized Musk's cuts to the federal government.
You need to go in and do analysis. In corporate America, you just don't fire a whole generation of people. Think of it.
There is some indication that all the out-of-state spending is wearing on Wisconsin voters. At one Republican rally, Mike Miller said as much.
Personally, I think it's gotten out of hand on both sides.
But Miller says he's still voting for Schimmel in the nonpartisan race for the Wisconsin Supreme Court. For NPR News, I'm Chuck Kornbach in Milwaukee.
By now, millions of Americans have spit into a tube and sent it to 23andMe for a detailed DNA analysis. But the California biotech company struggled for years to overcome the fact that many of them were one-and-done customers. Now, 23andMe is filing for bankruptcy with the goal of finding a buyer. And that has raised questions about what could happen to the sensitive information of its more than 15 million users. John Verde is Senior Vice President for Policy at the Future of Privacy Forum, and he joins me now to talk about all of it. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, John, if you could just start by laying out exactly what this bankruptcy filing means for users. What kinds of laws protect the types of data that we're talking about here?
Well, there are some state laws, there are some federal laws that protect the data, but what it really comes down to is that those laws typically focus on the uses and not parties. There's no obligation that 23andMe delete the data before selling the company. And that means that this information in past bankruptcies involving other sorts of data, personal information has been transferred to successor entities. And some folks are worried about that. Some folks are not worried about that. But that's the reality from where it is in the United States these days in terms of regulation.
The company is trying to find a buyer, and in a press release about the bankruptcy filing, the company says they're, quote, committed to continuing to safeguard customer data and being transparent about the management of user data going forward. I have to tell you, as someone, full disclosure, who has used 23andMe, I was a little concerned. So I'd love to know, in your view, how big of a risk is there of a user's genetic information ending up in someone else's hands?
Well, given the statements, I think it's pretty clear that that genetic information is going to end up in another entity's hands unless individuals delete their information. And that's something that they can do on the 23andMe website. 23andMe does provide the ability for folks to go ahead and delete their genetic profile, which is the data that was generated from the sample that you submitted. They also have the ability to go ahead and ensure that the company has destroyed the underlying biological sample. And that's typically more relevant for folks who have submitted the test more recently. But it's an important distinction between the data and the actual physical sample that the company did collect.
What types of protections exist in the event that a buyer does purchase 23andMe? Could a different company do whatever they want to with that data at that point?
A new company can definitely not do whatever they want to at that point. The successor entity would be bound by the original privacy promises and the terms and conditions that 23andMe made. And what that means is that if 23andMe could legally use the information for research, for example, today, then the successor entity could use that for research in the future. But if 23andMe promised not to, say, engage in targeted advertising with third parties using that genetic data, then the successor entity would likewise not be allowed to engage in that sort of activity.
Say someone listening to our conversation, they've sent in their genetic sample. They're now worried about where that data could end up, what it could be used for. What would you say to them?
I'd say if you're one of those one-and-done users who hasn't really engaged with 23andMe since they sent in their sample and got their test results and learned a little bit about their heritage or their health, folks might want to think seriously about either deleting the data or rethinking whether or not they are comfortable with an entity that is not 23andMe, which is somebody who they trusted, who they sent their information to, whether they're comfortable with another entity who's kind of unknown at this time, collecting, using that data in a way that is consistent with 23andMe's practices, but they're a different entity, right? They don't necessarily have that trust relationship today because that successor entity is by definition unknown.
That's John Verde. He's Senior Vice President for Policy at the Future of Privacy Forum. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And if you're looking to delete your data, NPR.org has a helpful step-by-step guide.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting The Penguin Lessons, a new comedy starring Steve Coogan as a teacher whose life is upended after he rescues a penguin from an oil-slicked beach. Starts Friday in theaters. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It is a minute before 5 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of All Things Considered, including the Up North Report, local news from our region at 5:30. Support comes from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji, gathering at 10 a.m. Sundays now through May at the Headwaters Peace Center. HUF is an inclusive space to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org. Mostly cloudy overnight, lows 20 to 27, and tomorrow, mix of clouds and sun, highs 40.